I'm delighted to be here, somewhat surprised that any such thing could happen, but when John Mulholland gets back of something, it tends to move along. It's been a great joy to come to know John. I can't remember quite where we met, but I'm glad for it, wherever it was. Now, the issue today, as far as I'm concerned, is to try to get as clear as possible about what we might mean when we talk about the redemption of reason. There are a lot of different ways you could combine those words. And in the context of where we stand, generally speaking, people think that there's something wrong with the order of the phrase, the redemption of reason, because it's generally assumed that reason is going to be the redemptor. And that if we want to talk about redeeming anything, it might be actually redemption. Redemption might be redeemed by reason. And we've had a long history now of thought along those lines. So I want to try to make as clear as possible in this time together exactly what we have in mind and why one might think that it is reason today that is in real trouble. Actually, this is not news to anyone who is familiar with the intellectual history of our culture and the universities. But still, though it's not new, it's often not taken very seriously. We want to take it seriously today. Now, everyone should have a handout. Is there anyone who does not have a handout? Perhaps we could get a few here. My thought is this, that when you come to discuss hard stuff, it's very hard to get it just as it goes by. And so I like to try to write down the main ideas so that we can look at them and think about them and disagree with them and analyze them and work on them, because it is work. And these remarks don't give you everything I'm going to try to say, but they give you the main parts, and I will try to keep you alerted as to where I am on the page. But before beginning, I want to do an overview. I want to give you a preview of what I'm talking about and try to give you an impression of why there is a problem with reason today. So let me just quickly go over these points. Reason is subject to pressures which deflect it from devotion to truth and goodness. Now, what I'm saying now, by the way, is not on your page. I'll come back to that in a moment. So let me just try, I'm just trying to summarize the point. Reason is subject to pressures, and in many, many ways, we'll talk about some of those, which deflect it from devotion to truth and serving the good of humanity. Now, that's nothing new. Anyone who has read the myth of Plato's cave, who has looked at what Descartes has to say in his Discourse on Method, recognizes that from the very beginning of the use of reason, the most brilliant place it shines forth is in Plato's works, and in particular Plato's Republic. You realize that this thing called reason is subject to pressures which deflect it from its proper function. The second thing that I want to say is that reason on its own cannot resist these pressures. Reason is actually, for all its power and promise, a very fragile sort of thing. In the human scene, it is subject to pressures which it cannot on its own resist. And so it must be supported on an ethic that rests on a conviction of the reality of goodness. Simple moral values in human life, like honesty and courage, and a willingness to be shown wrong. The Jewish proverb says, rebuke a wise man and he will love you for it. That's not a common human virtue. And one of the problems with reason is that it does not have in itself the power to sustain devotion to truth, goodness, and reality in the face of the pressures that come from being human, and especially in the social context. Plato, of course, I refer to him because he should be a known point of reference, understood that reason was of value, humanly valuable, only when subjected to the vision of good. Now, that's quite consistent with it being necessary to rise to the vision of the good. But on Plato's view, one of the greatest dangers was clever people. And he explicitly disqualifies clever people who do not subject themselves to the vision of the good from the responsibilities of leadership, and warned his readers about such people. And there were plenty of them in his day, and this is not a breed that is extinct. Reason itself has not, as a matter of fact, provided such an ethic, one that is actually capable of directing the lives of ordinary people, including academics. And this is simply something that is verifiable by observing the history of reason in our culture. And above all, where I spend a great deal of my time and currently trying to write in is contemporary ethical theory. And if there's anything that comes out of the study of that, it is the impotence of reason to provide an ethics for life. Now, the tradition of Christian, or more generously, biblical ethics has done so and can do so. Again, it can provide a context within which reason can serve the function to which it is appointed by its nature. And so such an ethic derived from the biblical sources offers the possibility of redemption of reason by framing reason within the tradition of Christian knowledge. That tradition fully employs reason, is not opposed to it, along with the other sources of knowledge, including revelation, sense perception, and just human experience. That's the main line that I'm going to be talking about. Now, we will have discussion. I'm going to go here for about 40 minutes, and then we'll hear from you. And perhaps I should just say, as I approach this subject, I do not approach it in any spirit of dogmatism, but rather in the spirit of inquiry. And if, on occasion, in my enthusiasm, I speak in tones which do not seem to encourage doubt, you will please remember that in my more sober moments, I realize how difficult it is to deal with these issues. And indeed, it is very difficult, almost every word. Many of the words I've used already in summarizing it, you sense, are landmines just waiting to be stepped on. And so I do approach it in that way. I'm sorry I won't be able to be very inspirational, I think. And you may have to pinch yourself occasionally to stay awake, or it may be more interesting, pinch the person next to you. So with those disclaimers and so on, let's now begin to work on the material you have on the printed handout. And we begin with the simple statement about what is reason. And this will take some work because, we'll explain. Very simply stated, reason is the human capacity to discover necessary connections by thinking, but not necessarily to the exclusion of the other two main sources of truth, perception and authority. Those are the primary sources, and it is a very interesting thing if you will go back over the history of Western and Eastern too, if you want to, that's fine, you'll find the same thing. You will see the interplay between these three sources: authority, sense perception, and reason. And actually, historically, there's a kind of dialectic that goes on there. And thinking is, as I describe it here, it has many different forms, but it is in general a matter of bringing things before the mind and attentively dwelling upon them and their properties and relations. For example, you are usually thinking when you try to balance your checkbook. Now, you don't have to do a lot of thinking because you're provided with a symbolic system that excuses you from thinking if you know how to work it. But on occasion, it will give you some surprises which will make you think, hopefully. And of course, one of the terrors of modern life is symbol systems with no unthinking. And there are many ways that works. Einstein was thinking when he was imagining what it would be like to ride a beam of light. And that was thinking. Goya was thinking when he was painting the insane evils that invade human existence while reason sleeps, if you remember that stunning painting, or those paintings of Goya, where he depicts the monstrous things that come when reason sleeps. And we see them all the time today. Mr. Mugabe cleaning up the slums. And you look at the horror imposed upon helpless people. And of course, these monsters usually come in personal form. Now, the human problem in general, back to your handout for a moment, is to secure knowledge to serve as a basis for action. Knowledge of what to aim at and of how to achieve the aim. The general public assumes that this is what our schools and universities are about and why they are worth maintaining. And I remember the wonderful statement of the University of Wisconsin, where I spent some time, about sifting, winnowing and sifting, and finding the truth. And see, that's the grand idealization, which I must say is totally justified. And I can't imagine any other reason why anyone would want to go through graduate school unless that were it. And actually, I watch generation after generation of people come in as freshmen. And you know, the difference between an undergraduate and a graduate student is when you walk in and say good morning, the undergraduates say good morning. Graduate students write it down. Life has gotten very serious. Well, I'm just kidding. Don't pay any attention to me. Now, so reason is absolutely vital to the human enterprise. We're not born like quail and lizards, knowing what to do once we pop the egg or whatever it is we come out of. We have to learn. And this general human problem is to find a basis in knowledge for action. And that's true whether you're a hunter-gatherer in the Kalahari or whether you're a hunter-gatherer on Wall Street. This is the human condition, and reason is absolutely essential to that. I've mentioned the book by Bruno Snell. I find many people today are no longer acquainted with this. It's a wonderful book, The Discovery of the Mind. And what an incredible shift it was when people around the Mediterranean, primarily in Egypt and the Greek cities and colonies, began to find out that just by thinking, you can discover things. Incredible things. Just by thinking. And then you could actually put some of it into practice on the world, and it worked. And no one had to tell you. And you didn't have to laboriously grind it out by examining one little detail after another. Just the marvels of triangles and circles and all that. And they didn't see really how it applied to the physical world, and they didn't think much of the physical world anyway, but they thought a lot about what they had discovered. And later on, of course, it becomes applied. Now, so reason is the traditional name for this human capacity, but that word has, for various reasons and causes, largely disappeared from our vocabulary. And that disappearance, indeed, is part of what any adequate treatment of our subject, the redemption of reason, would have to take into account. Reason, as classically understood, has too close an association with other words or ideas, such as reality, truth, and knowledge. I've used those quite straightforwardly already, and I would be surprised if you haven't felt a little uneasy about the use of those words. This whole interrelated group of terms is, and for some time now, has been in bad odor as descriptions of what academics or intellectuals do. Truth has been, in my experience, a ridiculous thing for quite a long while. Still, the most common saying on university walls, not written by spray paint, is the truth will make you free. And of course, it's totally taken out of context and misused, because the one who said it never said the truth will make you free. He said something else, and perhaps you may want to go back and read the whole sentence. In my shop over there in Southern California, in the elevator in the humanities building, it just says the truth will make you free. Apparently, you don't even have to know it now. And that's probably a good thing, because knowledge itself is also in trouble. I give you a quotation from a recent book called Glossolalia, An Alphabet of Critical Key Words. This is by one of my colleagues at USC. And the article is called simply Knowledge. And it starts out by saying, wow, can we really do this? It says, knowledge is not a word we expect to find in a glossary of cultural theory, even one as diverse as this. It has an unfashionable sound. When mentioned, it may be qualified almost beyond recognition. Now, I have to compliment her on the exquisite subtlety with which she makes the point. We may think that knowledge belongs to a different sort of endeavor than cultural theory. And she goes on to discuss this and says, among literary critics, only the naive and the polemically anti-theoretical call for a grounding in knowledge. Insofar as theory is aligned with literature, knowledge may even be regarded as a necessary exclusion. Now that's the viewpoint from one particular area of the university, which I imagine many of you are familiar with. But what I find is that even among my scientific colleagues, there is almost a total reticence to talk of knowledge. And now, what you see here is the gradual removal of the enterprise of reason from truth and knowledge. These are embarrassing topics. Now, the reason for much of this is, in fact, discoveries about reason and truth and knowledge, found out, of course, by thinkers. And what they found out was that reason was not what it purported to be, namely a kind of clear and unperturbed vision of truth and reality. It's always under the influence of something. Possibly the outright control of emotions, social pressures, conscious or unconscious factors. And here the whole string of names from Hume to Schopenhauer to Hegel to Marx to Nietzsche, Freud, Sartre, Foucault, Derrida, and so on comes to mind. So there's been a long process of undermining confidence in the capacity to think, primarily by showing that it is being manipulated by something usually behind the scenes, more or less. And so now, also religion, from Tertullian to Luther, to Kierkegaard, and to the heavy-handed anti-intellectualism of numerous strong currents in American religion, has long had its suspicions about reason and who and what was really running the show. Luther, as I recall, on one occasion refers to reason as the devil's whore. Well, that's a pretty powerful image of how reason can be degraded and why it needs redemption or buyback from the various slaveries into which it can fall and into which it does fall. So you don't hear a lot of talk about reason nowadays. There used to be a lot, 100 years, 150 years ago. Rationalism was a form of opposition to religion that was in the popular conversation, showed up at Chautauquas and places of that sort, and in popular writings, and you had your popular lecturers. But that now is not as common. But you can't dispense with the function of reason. It doesn't matter what you say, whether you're religious, anti-religious, or whatever, you're going to wind up reasoning. Because it is the primary way that we organize things and come to what at least we can regard as a way of dealing with our realities. So the function goes underground and reemerges as research. So if we want to get clearly before us what we're talking about today, perhaps we should speak of the redemption of research. And research manages to dispense with a lot of the associations with truth and knowledge. So, for example, every university wants to be a research university. I've never found one who wanted to be a knowledge university. Very strange how that works. But it's very deep when you start thinking about it. Research turns out to be subject to all the conscious and unconscious influences found impinging on, distorting to, reason, because in fact it's just the same thing under different words. So then you have many people in recent decades, call them post-structuralist, deconstructionist, postmodernist, or so whatever, the usual suspects, Derrida, Foucault, Barthes, and others, have tried to make a virtue out of this necessity and have tried to say that research indeed is just a kind of social ferment and results are only things that emerge for the moment and can be sustained in the social context. I think I won't carry on that any further. I hope that makes the point that there is some serious difficulty confronting the individual and the institutions of reason and research today. So back to your page, the next to the last paragraph on the first page. A major issue then facing the individual in the academic world today is what truths and standards can guide my research and, of course, my teaching towards the good implicit in the drive towards truth and knowledge? I hope you can identify that question, because that's the one I want to focus on now for a while. What truths and standards can guide my research and, of course, my teaching towards the good implicit in the drive towards truth and knowledge? Or is the only applicable standard of the quality of my research or reasoning simply the professional status which I manage to negotiate in my professional context? Is my social and professional environment the ultimate horizon for the guidance, sustenance, and evaluation of my work and my life as a scholar, scientist, thinker? Well, at present, for most people in academia, especially for younger people, I think the answer to that question is yes. Fitting in with or successfully moving within the thought content current swirling around them in their professional associations, and respecting a ragtag collection of moral ideals that are vaguely, if powerfully, with it, is about all that can guide them toward good work, or at least toward being successful. Those around them reward them for what, for that kind of work that fits in with the social context. No further questions asked. What is good research or work that will be rewarded today is work that adapts to the social currents. And here, I mention on your sheet, Lyotard's book, The Postmodern Condition, a report on knowledge, which if you have not read and are interested in this topic, you should by all means try to read. It can be read as a reliable, if somewhat exaggerated, account of good work or legitimation, as he calls it. He changes the language because he's moving away from ideas of truth and reality and social and these kinds of things, because those are regarded simply as old-fashioned ways of talking about something that's no longer acceptable. But legitimation is, of course, necessary because people still need to get jobs and get promoted and get a raise and get published. And that's called legitimation. Research is simply a social ferment of some sort, and there is no redeeming of it by reference to anything beyond it, then, of course, that ends the discussion. All one can do is go with the flow, as we say. Learn to swim in your social context. Find out where the power is, as Foucault would say. Find out where the power is, move with the power. That's it. And the young person or the old person, unless, you know, you get as old as I am, you're beyond hope, so no one worries about you anymore. You don't have to go with the flow. That's one of the joys of getting older. So you can lay that aside. The flow has already gone, so then you can pay attention to other things. But if one says yes to this question now, then one has the task of saying, what are the other standards? Standing in the flow, what do I look to? See, that's what you have to come up with. If you say, well, there is something else to guide me. And how, then you have to talk about how is that accessible? Now, back to the top of your second page. If one says no to that last question, that is the question, is my social and professional environment the ultimate horizon for my work and life, then one has to state what could serve as alternative points of reference in determining what is good intellectual work and what is not. And for most of our history, as I've already indicated, the answer to that is clear. These were two, mainly: faithfulness, accuracy, truth to the subject matter, concerned, reality, service to what was good, moral good, and other goods. And these were thought to provide the standard against which the use or abuse of reason, now research, could be judged and even corrected. So, as long as you have that sort of point of reference, then, as on the traditional view, one might be in good professional standing and do bad work. Depends on your professional standing. If your professional standing is, your professional context is somehow corrupted, then the fact that you're in good standing wouldn't mean much. Right? And as the old saying is, one is known by their enemies. You could also be doing good intellectual work because you have other standards and not be widely accepted. Right? We remember Copernicus and Galileo and people of that sort. And so you have a point of reference from which you can then make judgments about the use of reason and research. Plato had that, of course, when he commented on those clever people who use reason dialectically but should be excluded from the responsibilities of leadership because they're just going to use dialectic and reason to advance themselves and whatever causes they may be attached to. But Plato was definitely not a postmodernist. Now then, we are in a predicament. And the main paragraph there in the middle of page 2 of your handout, I try to spell this out some. How are standards of truth and reality and goodness to be discerned and applied? This is, I would say, the greatest question facing the institutions of education and research in our time. And so much that I will say here needs to be deepened in so many ways. I just have to say what we can, and then perhaps the discussion can open it up more effectively. So here's the problem. How can we accept reality and morality as standards by which reason or research are to be guided and judged if they, that is reality and morality, are not themselves certified as truth and goodness by reason and research? Reason must be defined independently of reality and morality if it is to be what says what they are. There must be knowledge of reality and goodness independent of reasoning and research if there is to be a standard by which reason and its results can be judged. Now see, once you understand that, the bind you're in, then the next sentence, the temptation to retreat to negotiated professional standing as the only standard of good intellectual work seems irresistible. Now, that, because that's so important, let me just wander and stumble around over it a bit here. I mean, see, the issue is, where are you going to get the knowledge on the basis of which you can evaluate the success or failure of the institution of research? What can you even raise the question about whether or not research is successful or not? Okay, are you stuck in the flow of it and can't rise above it? See, it's this kind of problem that gives rise to famous pieces of philosophy such as C.S. Peirce's, the American philosopher C.S. Peirce's statement that truth is what the community of inquiry converges on. And those of you who have read Kuhn and other philosophers of science and have dealt with the issue of what is called commensurability of theories to reality and so on, and the idea that has pretty well taken over entirely, there is no commensurability. It's just a matter of one theory after another. And so Kuhn and other pragmatists, Richard Rorty, a more well-known name, takes the same view generally. Philosophers of science such as Feyerabend and Foucault, same way, the idea of progress disappears because there's no way that you could define progress. And that's the predicament. Now then, So I hope that sentence says something to you. The temptation to retreat to negotiated professional standing, status, as the only standard of good intellectual work seems irresistible. Okay? But then reason cannot be redeemed from its slavery to social forces. Its institutional setting cannot protect it, but only becomes a part of the problem. I mention here a book by Max Weinreich called Hitler's Professors. And if you ever wish to look in historical and sociological depth at what can happen to reason, read this book. And you will find people with the highest education and honestly, the highest abilities. I mean, these people were not dummies. I mean, they were smart people. But what this book so brilliantly shows by really very little comment and just giving the history of it is how institutionalized reason can be totally swept away by evil. Totally swept away by evil. And it is not an accident that the most outstanding people who resisted Hitler were religious people, Protestants and Catholics. Now you ask yourself, why were they able to do that? And the answer is because they had a different standard than social standing and acceptance to judge the correctness of the same thing in communist Russia, the Lushenko deal in biology. And the social pressure is so great. Well, that's a garish example. One hesitates to use such examples because they are quite inflammatory to the imagination and the emotions. But some of us lived through the social pressures of the 60s. I had colleagues who refused to give any grade other than A. And in fact, this policy was, in a more measured fashion, adopted by many universities, whole faculties adopted. And we have not, maybe you've recovered here, but in no institution do I know of, including the very best by the social standards, have we yet recovered from what is called grade inflation. And before that, there was something called the gentleman's C. Weren't even too many ladies around to get a lady's C. But now it's the gentleman's B plus in most areas. And that's an apologetic way to say, we're so sorry that we couldn't quite give you the top of the line, but you know, you didn't do badly. And the struggle with this that conscientious professors go through is, of course, well known. Then we have the issue of political correctness about what questions can be asked. The very asking of a question betrays that you have somehow wound up on the wrong side of this issue. And the recent experience, for example, of the president of Harvard is only one illustration of someone who asks a question and then spends the next years of their life fighting to recover from having asked the question. That's what used to happen in religion, of course. If you ask a question, that meant you were already on the wrong side. Well, of course, it isn't religion that does that, nor is it the universities. It's just humanity that does it. Menschliche, also menschliche, as Nietzsche put it. Human, all too human. So, next paragraph there. Biblical revelation, authority, perception, and common sense have all made claims to provide a standard against which the process and claims of reason could be judged. But the theories of reason, the big word is theory, and theory has come to mean kind of intellectual free flight. When you get into theory, as the quotation I gave you earlier from that book, Glossalia, indicates, you can lay aside knowledge. You don't need a knowledge basis for theory. In fact, a knowledge basis is a constricting factor in your theorizing. And when you read, if you read the book by Léotard that I mentioned, The Postmodern Condition, you'll see that what is legitimated in what he calls knowledge, he wrote the book, by the way, at the request of some of the Canadian French universities in Canada. What is legitimated is creativity that is often generated by conflict and even contradiction. And creativity of that sort is what is legitimated, not. And a theory is a word today that basically stands for free flight, intellectual free flight. And theories of reason have in many ways managed in our current world to undercut the claims of perception and common sense, not to mention authority and biblical revelation. And to even mention biblical revelation and authority generates a whole group of ghosts that come screaming out of the atmosphere. Right? Don't say that word! Right? And so, with research progressively defined in terms of the natural sciences and strictly humanistic inquiry, any cognitive basis for morality is lost. And moral knowledge disappears from the intellectual scene. And if you have not read, I'm so pleased to see that Julie Rubin's book over here, The Making of the Modern University, if you have not read that book, please read it. Julie did her PhD in Stanford in history, is in the School of Education at Harvard now. And an administrative history of universities, of which the University of Chicago is a central one, about how first religion and then morality disappeared from the cognitive domain. Now, when those disappear, then of course standards that might be used to evaluate research and reason go with it. I mentioned here Stanley Fish, Chronicle of Higher Education, in an article in the May 6th, 2003. He's reviewing a book that actually is talking about how the universities have the responsibility to educate citizens for responsible citizenship. And the title of Fish's review is Aim Low. Aim low. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, aim low, you won't be disappointed. And that's his advice. Basically, what Fish is saying is don't try to educate people morally. And that makes perfect sense if there's no body of knowledge in terms of which you can educate them, right? But most people don't understand that that's where we have come. And Julie Rubin's book is a wonderful treatment of how we got there, and it is just an administrative history. It's a history, it deals with the statements of the presidents and the boards of the universities, all of the main ones in the country, if you listed the top whatever, Berkeley and Chicago and Princeton and Harvard and Michigan, Stanford, right down the line, just goes through how that discourse changed. And even if you're not in the academic world, if you're a pastor or a leader in some of the religious organizations, you really need to read this to know what our situation is, because many people do not understand that moral knowledge has disappeared from our culture. And they still think that someone is teaching it. I want to just mention in this capacity, in this connection, I did not put this in the notes, but it's especially relevant here because the class that would graduate from University of Chicago in 2001, John Mearsheimer, a professor here at the time, I don't know where he is now, gave the yearly aims of education address. Every entering class apparently here gets one of these. And I don't know how widely that's heard or anything, but this one really created a stir and wound up with a reproduction and a whole series of responses. If you want to see these, they're in a journal called Philosophy and Literature, Philosophy and Literature, 1998, volume 22, 136 through 199. I don't know, John, have you put that reference in the materials for the conference? Great. Okay, it's really worth studying. Here's what Mearsheimer says. I'll just give it to you very simply. He comments, as would be usual, that at the University of Chicago, we do teach you critical thinking, broadening intellectual horizons, and promoting self-awareness. And this, of course, calls no alarm. It's the kind of academic ease that we all use and understand that it has very little bearing on what we're going to do. But he also states two non-aims of the University of Chicago, and he states it with the understanding that all properly framed universities are the same. And these are, first, we don't provide truth. And that one didn't upset many people. No one said, oh yes, we do. But the second non-aim was, we don't teach morality. And while everyone was comfortable with the first, they were upset with the second. Now, it's very interesting that they would be. And I do hope you might, if you're interested in this, have time to look over this collection of responses to Mearsheimer's address. Because interesting that the faculty divided, the faculty's people divided on this. And some said, oh yes, we do teach it. And others said, we didn't teach it. And when you get into it, you realize that the people who said we do teach it meant, well, we discuss it. And we read Billy Budd or something of that sort, novels, and do plays, and we get people to thinking about it. And this group obviously thought it made a great difference to the lives of the people that they taught in their classes. Others rejected that, and what they were rejecting, of course, was something different. No one's opposed to discussing morality. What Mearsheimer was actually talking about was, you don't tell people what is right and wrong. You don't tell them what they ought to do. You try to lay a foundation on the basis of which supposedly they can come by reasoning to the right conclusions. Now, this is what Stanley Fish was saying, don't try it. And he was saying, frankly, you can't do it. And Fish, in his article, says there are only two things that you can do. You can come out against plagiarism and against cheating. Now, actually, it's very interesting to look at those two cases. I'm very familiar with this, because you can't teach those as morality. And that's why the teaching that is done on it is almost totally feckless. And the students cheat right and left, and they don't think there's anything wrong with it. And actually, what Stanley was saying was simply that if you come to this campus, you have, by coming, agreed you will not cheat and you will not plagiarize, because that's what it says in the official papers, and that's the condition on which you're here. But that has nothing to do with morality. It's like professional morality generally now is actually not morality, but how to stay out of trouble. Professional ethics basically deals with how to stay out of trouble. It doesn't tell you anything about how to be a good person. It doesn't even touch that. If you try to raise that issue in professional ethics context, people will laugh at you or throw you out of the room. Because that we are not going to discuss. But of course, that's the only level of discussion of morality that you can communicate it in such a way that it actually makes a difference in life. And now I don't want to go too far on this because we have to conclude and let you have a shot at saying something. But the truth of the matter is, on the university campus, we endlessly, constantly teach morality. See, what Mearsheimer was actually saying was, we don't teach traditional morality. You can teach radical morality right and left. And in fact, it's almost a condition of being in good standing that you do that. And in fact, Mr. Mearsheimer's lecture was, in fact, teaching morality. He was teaching the conditions upon which individuals are accepted as good or bad. And in particular, the conditions upon which university faculty are accepted as good or bad. And one of those conditions is you do not teach traditional morality, and you don't teach it by preaching. Now, actually, you can preach radical morality, and that's okay. You can preach it, and it's done over and over. It's done at my university constantly. But because it's not traditional morality, and it's taught maybe by showing movies or other things, body language, looks, expressions, and so on, it's not thought to be teaching morality. One of the great advantages of that, of teaching something without teaching it, is you don't have to defend it. And so if you can float that idea that you're not doing it, then you don't have to defend it. And that's one of the things that happens in the position that reason gets itself in today. Well, just quickly to wrap up here. As the Rubin book makes clear, it was historically the removal of religion from the cognitive arena that eventually led to the removal of morality from pedagogy in the American universities. I'm now at the top of page 3. The other universities' faculties, one of the most fascinating things in the book is how, for example, when the universities, this is in the official language of the universities, when they put religion aside as a cognitive basis for anything, it was the science faculties that they thought would teach morality. And that was because they thought, well, who is most devoted to truth? Well, the scientists are. Now, you're looking at me unbelievingly, and I really hope you will check this out, because there is a kind of naive confidence in reason as it was embodied in the sciences, which we're now doing research and uncovering new. And you know, from a certain point of view, it makes sense, doesn't it? But it didn't work out. The scientists didn't want the job. And then they turned it over to the social sciences, and they didn't want it after a while either. And then they gave it to the humanities, where, depending on your viewpoint, they didn't want it either, or it's still raging on there in a great way. Now, that's just an observation about the history of it. It's not an observation about the nature of things, not a statement to the effect that there's no morality without religion, for example. It's simply a statement of how things developed in the making of the modern university. The university is now the cultural authority on everything through its research. The practice of morality in the universities was tied to religious belief and practice. That's a fact. Read Marsden's book on the soul of the American university. No other foundation for morality was established when religion was removed from the area of knowledge. I submit that as a simple fact. Gradually, one field of knowledge after another removed itself from theology. A very famous incident that Marsden tells in his book, if you haven't read it, I hope you will, is about Yale in the early 1880s. And Noah Porter, who was the president, and then in those days the president read and approved of every text that was used. And William Graham Sumner was going to use Herbert Spencer's Sociology. And Noah Porter read it and said to William Graham Sumner, "This says nothing about God. Why is that?" And Sumner replied, "Because God has nothing to do with the subject matter." Now that one statement summarizes the overall progression and gives you the assumption that is current, that God, anything about religion other than sociology, history, has nothing to do with the subject matter of any of the disciplines. Now, did Spencer prove that? Of course not. And by the way, Noah Porter won that battle and lost the war. Porter saw, rightly, that if you make that assumption when you do your political theory, which is what, as I recall this course, if you make that assumption, you're doing theology. He was able to see that this was a profound statement about the subject matter in a discipline. And at that point, to see that there was some kind of justification needed. But of course, the social currents were flowing and he was simply overwhelmed as they went by. So religious belief is defined out of relevance to academic fields, again, not by research, but by declaration. And that irrelevance is now internalized into Christians who receive their intellectual professional formation in PhD granting institutions, where such irrelevance is so far assumed that it would not even be discussed. Thus, what is actually taught as truth and course content is the issue. What is taught as course content in Christian institutions by Christians in whatever institution differs very little from that anywhere else. If you take a course in economics in a Christian school, you will study economics as a discipline to which God has no cognitive relevance. And they may pray before they have the class, or after, or only during tests, or whatever. Right? But the irrelevance is assumed. Cognitive irrelevance. That's where the battle has to be fought. Consequently, integration of faith and intellect does not usually extend to the course content and research in Christian schools any more than in secular institutions. No one is seriously inquiring into the relationship between chemistry and the resurrection of the dead, or the contents of the Apostles' Creed, or between law, or business administration, and the clearly cognitive contents of the New Testament. Little more is intended by integration, as commonly understood, than being a good Christian person on the job. Well, those are inflammatory remarks, and we'll see what you want to say. So just to summarize the situation here, reason can be supported in its devotion to truth and goodness only in a moral life that is fortified by a morality based on knowledge and reality. It is not a self-sustaining power. A morality based on knowledge and reality is not now available, only one based on feeling and social pressure. Reason itself has not been able to provide an objective and life-guiding morality. So research, reason, falls prey to drives for social dominance, political motivations, individual advancement, intellectual respectability. Is this the case today? Now, if it is, then, of course, we have a real problem. And we are in a position where, in the words of Richard Rorty, truth is just what you're able to get your colleagues to accept. Okay, final paragraph there then. What are the resources of the Christian or any religion for dealing with the plight of reason and its bondage to social forces that surround it? For opening up the institutional settings of reason research to genuinely free inquiry into all the questions left unanswered by the type of research now acceptable? Can it free itself from its institutional and social bondages? The question of the redemption of reason turned out to be inseparable from the question of redemption of religion itself. And we shall have to go at some of these questions in the next talk. Thank you. Now, do we have...
pushing the time limit, but we absolutely need these questions, and Professor Willard, as you can see, has a ton of stuff to say. Second, and very importantly, we have worked very diligently on the website for this conference to fill it with useful information, starting with Professor Willard's original lecture that inspired this thing, this particular conference, and then references to Mearsheimer, a very interesting article by Robert Coles, which Donald Fuller has spoken of in other cases, where a student came to him and on this issue of morality, came to him and said, I'm in the slot, she was a student at Harvard, and her part-time job was cleaning rooms. Well, time after time, she was harassed by the man in the dormitory, propositioning. Now, in one case, the guy was a student in ethics classes that she had taken with him, and she walked into Cole's classroom in a fury. What is going on at this university that this guy behaves this way?
Makes A's.
Right. Well, he's just kind of throwing back on his heels and going, what am I supposed to do? Well, she in the end quit the Harvard University because she said, there's no connection. You teach this class that deals with ethics, but it doesn't teach us how to behave. So this issue, and this is another one of the articles that's on the website, this issue is so powerful. And had I not read Lord on this issue, I would never have made the connection between reason and morality. So now, go at it. Let's take, we're going to spill over a little bit, but then rush out. We'll take 10 minutes of questions and rush out and get back. There's a men's room on this floor. The women's restroom is on the next floor. We have somebody here who has some water bottles, and we'll see if we can get water if anybody needs it. So, please. First question.
Statements or questions? Yes.
The claim is very widely accepted that reasoning or research is really only legitimation activity. And you're right to point that out. I wonder, though, could it be that that claim is itself an expression of the quest for legitimation? If so, why would it have an obligation to accept? That's a rhetorical question.
If legitimation in that sense is all there is to it, one would have no obligation. The object would be, if you didn't like it, just try to undermine the status of the claim.
But it would seem to be a self-refuting proposition.
Well, it is. Self-refutation is a very interesting thing. It depends on you thinking it out. And you can always escape self-refutation by stopping your thought at a certain point. It's really true. I mean, and often, people, if you try to bring up self-refutation, people often think you're somehow cheating on them. You're trying to corner them, and they stop thinking. So that's why the kind of reference to the social background is so powerful. And if anyone really interested in this, as I'm sure many of you are, you find it very helpful to read that book of Lyotard's, because it's as a description of what goes on in this context, it's very powerful. Yes, ma'am. Well, there's a problem with communicating with the general public. See, the university, and I'm not saying this to be mean or anything, but the university works very hard in managing its image. And that image, if you go to Parent Day, you will find that image is curiously incongruent with a lot of things. I remember a few years ago, we had a conference, some bunch of us got together, had a conference on French intellectuals in the American university. The president of Roosevelt University here in Chicago attended that conference. And after he'd listened to us for a day and a half, he got up and said, "Do you people understand what you're doing? We go out and beat the bushes and raise money and attract students on the idea that they're going to come and learn something here, something important. And you get up and tell them there isn't anything important. And that actually there's no such thing as knowledge." Well, you see, there is a great incongruity here. And that's partly due to the loss of public intellectuals. That is, people who can stand in the public as well as in the university and say what's the truth, what's going on. And so I do think the real issue is communication, and it's not a simple proposition, because then all the other things that we've been taught by Habermas and other people, Horkheimer and the rest of them, about the difficulty of getting straight talk beyond individual intentions, but the capacity to overcome all the barriers to communication, that's something that we have to solve. Now, my own view is that it is the ministers and the rabbis who have the responsibility to be public intellectuals. And I would challenge anyone, no matter how what your church is or what you stand, if you're in that business, you are a public intellectual. You have the responsibility to understand the course content and what is taught by the body language, and to address that from the point of view of one who has a reference outside of that social ferment, and to do it in a way that people both in the ferment and out can understand it. It's a very important point. This gentleman back here.
You presented a reason in your talk as engaged in reality and truth and knowledge.
Right, that's what it's for.
Yes, at least that it's natural order for these things. And that's a teleological view of reason.
A teleological view? Yeah. A teleology is always based on essence. So what it is basic. What it does derives from what it is.
And you can, as a philosopher, because I'm a graduate student in philosophy myself.
Good for you.
Well, then this theory of reason, you know, there's definitely inconsistent between all of that and philosophy and all this theory of reason. But I would ask you, what if you're a Christian who finds himself an academic, a social science department, in anthropology or
Right.
Then how can you be hold this view of reason and work in these fields in any other way than to sort of critique the underlying fundamentals?
By being good reasoners. That's the short answer. Why do we have PhDs in every field? I'm redundant. I'm a PhD in philosophy. But as soon as you're a PhD in anthropology, you're a doctor of philosophy in anthropology. The reason that is called that is because a person at that level is supposed to have been able to master the fundamentals of the field. That's why it's called philosophy. And I realize now that that's a far cry from what actually happens in many PhD programs. And increasingly, we're turning out PhDs like assembly lines. I serve on a lot of committees outside of philosophy. And in many of them, the committee in the department approves of how the study is set up. And then you do the study, and you succeed, no matter what you find. That doesn't get us down to those fundamentals. So what you have to do to a person, with a person in anthropology or elsewhere, is to get them to asking fundamental questions. How do they study what they study? What are the assumptions they're making when they study them? And of course, the big theorists like Claude Lévi-Strauss of some time ago and others, they have a lot to say about that, and they tend to captivate the field. So our fields are dominated by glittering personalities and passing fads. And if you look back over them, you can see it's like driving through Israel, where you see all the old burnt out trucks and the tanks and all that that's been left there from the past wars. And so what we have to do is to get people to thinking about what they're doing. And of course, it's a huge challenge. Most people wouldn't even stand still while you said the words truth and reality, because they've already dismissed that on the theory that the human mind is incapable of that. And that's where we get down to something really fundamental. And so I certainly, it's a big problem, and all I can say is the answer is more reason. And you, there's also, that will lead you beyond reason. This gentleman here?
Okay, one more question.
Oh, sorry. And please, if you don't get your question here, write it down. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about it or whatever. Did you say methods?
Metaphysics.
Well, if you press that, you'll get into metaphysics. That's right. And actually, you can't escape it. You're already there. When you say things like, well, everything is a social construct and so on, you're already there. That's right. You have to go there. Now, worldview is absolutely appropriate. And the only difference between metaphysics as it at least should be done and has been done in its better moments, and worldview, is that worldview does not require reason. You get a worldview just by being born. And one reason why religion can be so powerful is religion is ready-made worldview. And so you can get bad religion and good religion in those terminologies. So worldview, metaphysics, those are things that PhDs should deal with. Well, it's in so many respects, I'm just skating over abysses here, and you realize this. But what I would want to say is that morality presupposes a metaphysics. That one of the things that we're engaged in currently is trying to have a morality without a metaphysics. And this is unthinkingly and dogmatically usually caught up under the phrase, which you all must know, that you cannot deduce ought from is. In other words, ought just floats in the air. Like that. And of course, it doesn't. All morality that governs life is based on the sense of reality of the values involved. And that's one reason why morality has become such a football and windbag in so many contexts today. Thank you very much, John.